find interesting, it's like you say you became a creationist first and then a believer. Was your process of becoming a creationist, was there something sort of like a cataclysmic thing, or was it just a growing looking at the evidence and saying, well, I have to go with this?
It was about a 7 or 8 month series of conversations I had with a coworker. He found out I was an evolutionist and challenged me on it. He was Christian and very much into apologetics, very interested in the same types of things I am now, actually. And he knew evolutionary theory as well as I did, better in some cases, because he knew where all the weaknesses were and all the problems with it. So I had all the standard responses to his questions, but those questions are inadequate, because when you really study carbon dating, the fossil record, and all the other various things, it doesn't match the evolutionary model at all. And for context, as a child, I was very into dinosaurs, and I was going to be a paleontologist as a career choice until my mid-teenage years, when I was offered a scholarship in engineering, which I took. And then while in college, my interest had shifted from the ground to the sky. Some sort of switch was thrown, and I went from being obsessed with geology and paleontology to being obsessed with astronomy and cosmology. So looking backward, I think that was part of God's plan. But by the time I spoke to him, I thought I knew the whole story from the ground to sky. And his challenging me on the basic incompatibilities of evolutionary theory with the laws of science that we used in our work every day, the first time he challenged me on it was actually on the Big Bang and its incompatibility with thermodynamics. And he said, you believe in thermodynamics, don't you? And I said, well, yes, we use them every day here. And he said, well, how do you reconcile that with the Big Bang? And he didn't even explain what he meant. He didn't have to. Because, like, a little light switch went on. It's like, oh, wait a minute. I believe two incompatible things at the same time. And that was a problem for me. And so that started a whole sequence of months of research and looking at every science I could think of, trying to find a way out of this. And I'll point in the wrong direction. So I eventually had to acknowledge that, yes, the creation event, as given in the Bible specifically, were true. And I, especially with the Bible, with the account of Noah's flood, because I now understood that a lot of the so-called evidence given for long ages, when actually looked at in more depth, showed that there was a global flood a few thousand years ago. But I resisted that for a long time, because it's a series of dominoes, and once you knock the first one over, they all fall down. Because if there was a creation, and I am created, and there is a creator, and I have responsibility to that creator, who sets standards that I have violated, and on it goes. And there's no stopping, which is why everybody draws the line back here, because all the rest are going to fall down if you hit the first one. So yes, I acknowledge evidence for creation first, and wrestled with the idea of submitting to the Lord for a while, until finally it dawned on me, hey, stupid, wait, this is the good news. Yes, God, if God hates your sin, yes, he judges people who violate his standards, but he loves you enough to know everything you've done. You know, he knows you better than you know yourself, and yet has come to pay for that sin himself. So it's like, well, why am I resisting this? And so I became a Christian. So that's how that process took place. But before I continue, let me clarify one thing. The DVD of mine that George mentioned, this is on the solar system specifically. So the first third, roughly, of my talk is contained in this. This is an hour and 40 minutes of going planet by planet. This talks not only about each planet, some of which I had to skip tonight, but also many of the moons. And each of them pose severe challenges to the evolutionary interpretation of things. The other material after the solar system stuff that you heard tonight will be in future DVDs, but right now that's on the solar system specifically. So.
Thank you. That was a very fascinating and eye-opening presentation. I really appreciate it. I have a question that sort of stems to the fundamental of your presentation, and that is the whole concept that the only two elements that were originating at the so-called Big Bang were helium and hydrogen. And so my question is, and this gets into the whole chemistry myth of transformers.
the basic idea is that hydrogen and helium form the first stars, and that nuclear fusion can make new elements because you're actually fusing protons together and neutrons. So as nuclear fusion occurred, in the very first generation of stars, they were hydrogen only. Those first generation fused in their cores, made new elements, and then when they went supernova and blew up, they distributed the new elements out in the universe. Other stars could then take those new elements into their material and burn and so on. I'm giving a little more detail than what you asked for, because that model predicts that the first generation of stars had only hydrogen and a little bit of helium and nothing else. These are called population 3 stars. One of the predictions the Big Bang model makes is that some of those stars should still be around today. They've been looking for 50 years and they haven't found a single one. Every star we've ever seen has at least some elements in it, metals is the answer. An astronomer says anything other than hydrogen and helium is a metal. Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go. But every star we've seen has some metals in it. Population 3 stars don't exist. So the answer to the immediate question is that they believe the elements were made inside of stars, which is why the New Agers say we're all made of stardust, if you've ever heard that. But it highlights another problem for their model.
I just have an observation that perhaps you could comment on. We watch a lot of nature shows, and I have to say that it's irritating to hear the evolutionary talk, but I've noticed a growing trend. They keep on saying that evolution has designed, or this animal has been engineered by evolution, or the creation of this feature by evolution. And so they're appropriating creationist terms and intelligent design terminology and applying them to evolution. And I'm wondering if you could just give us a comment on that, and do you have any ways that you can combat that kind of thought? And then my second question is, could you make any comments on the latest incarnation of string theory, which is M theory?
The answer to your first question is yes, I agree, it's outrageous. I'm not sure what we can do about it. M theory gets into multiverse, and there's brains and multi-brains and some other stuff. I don't claim to fully understand it. It's changing constantly anyway. And it's all hypothetical. So, that's about all I can tell you, is that it's a variation of string theory, multiverses, spinning one after the other. So, I think he wants to. Yes? You can just call her.
I'll just talk bluntly. I have a friend who's very into that. She is an astrophysicist as well. And are there any resources that would be helpful for me to try, other than nothing but theology?
Oh boy, it's hard to combat something which is purely hypothetical. Like dark matter, for example, is being used to explain away all sorts of things. Dark matter is now being invoked to explain the first generation of stars and get around the need old stars to make new stars problem. They say, well, there was dark matter, and that was everything coalesced around. But because nobody knows what dark matter is, you can't say what it isn't. And so because it has no properties, you can include it in the model and make it do anything you want, because nobody can say it can't do that. So the multiverse thing, since it's all just pure speculation, you can't disprove any of it, because how do you disprove a story?
Good point.
I'm not sure there's a scientific resource to send you to, other than, some of the evidence for design is good. Ultimately, it's a question of worldviews. If you accept the Big Bang is true and then interpret everything else accordingly, it's hard to break someone out of that. Do you have ultimate proof of creation on the table, George?
No.
Okay. There's a resource called The Ultimate Proof of Creation by Jason Lyle, who's a PhD astronomer. And he talks about, I have a whole presentation on this as well, talks about how to combat worldviews. That in order, when someone's locked into their way of looking, and we do the same thing. We view things through a biblical interpretation. They're viewing things through an atheistic interpretation. And so it's hard to break someone free out of their way of looking at things. And that, the book I mentioned and some other materials, I can give you separately if you're curious, talks about showing somebody that the evolutionary atheistic worldview is ultimately foundationless. that the concepts they use, like design, engineered, whatever, are borrowing from our worldview and do not fit with theirs. And if you really dig down into the atheistic worldview, they can't use science consistently either. Because to use science, you have to make certain assumptions about how the universe works that are inconsistent with the atheistic worldview. If the Big Bang happened by a random chance event, if the entire universe came out of random chance, then how can you say that there are laws of physics? How can you assume that it's going to happen consistently one day to the next? You can't. How can you have laws of logic and abstract notions like that if everything is just molecules in motion? How can Richard Dawkins complain that God of the Bible is evil if he doesn't believe in God and therefore has no standard of good or evil to judge by? I mean, ultimately, morality is arbitrary, so you can't use an accusation like evil. Dawkins has to use a biblical worldview in order to try to disprove the Bible, which is self-refuting, and as all the other atheists do. Yeah. I'm straying off your original point, and George warned me not to do that, so. I'll do that later. There's several other things I can recommend for you.
I've got one short, easy question and one longer question. The short question is Psalm 19:1 object. What was that called? The picture of the.
Oh, the Cat's Eye Nebula.
Oh, that's the Cat's Eye.
Yeah, looks like the eye of a cat.
Okay, and then here's a hard question. You've got the classical Einsteinian quantum and string physics, and so much of it's hypothetical. Just what is the real physics that's based on reality, not mathematical games? That's what I was wondering. And have you heard of scalar physics, for instance? Is there any substance to that? Any other physics that we should know about?
I mean, physics is physics. A lot of the problem with the stuff we're discussing is that it's straying into philosophy. I mean, they've left the realm of physics, really. If you're good at, well, I guess how you define physics. Stuff you can verify experimentally would be good physics. When you get to a set of equations that doesn't make any testable predictions, then that would be outside of physics. From that definition, though, evolution isn't science either. Because when you look at a giraffe, what prediction can you make about what it's going to evolve into a million years from now? You know, you can't predict anything with evolutionary theory. So evolution is technically outside the bounds of science. But the scientific community would object violently if you said that. So our definition of science would be different than theirs, so I'm not sure where we're going to end that discussion. That answer your question?
We'll take two more questions, and then I think Spike is going to meet some of you at the front here if you have some additional ones.
Sure.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the moon. Our moon, and you know, they were really interested in getting up there about 40 years ago, and they seem to have lost interest. And I was just wondering if you had an opinion like why they haven't revisited our moon with such interest.
Well, a large part of the motivation for it was gone. It was a race to get there between the U.S. and the USSR. And now that it's been done, you will no longer be the first one to get there, so all the glory is gone. It's tremendously expensive to do, and the U.S. is in a tremendous amount of debt and getting worse every day. So even as someone interested in this stuff, I think our priority should be elsewhere. So I can't comment on what the politicians are doing anyway. NASA is increasingly shifting to private space exploration. There's been several contests recently as to who can get a vehicle in orbit. And there's two companies competing. The guy from Virgin, Richard, what's his name? Branson? Yeah, he's involved in that now. So my personal prediction is that we're going to see a lot of advances in the commercial sector rather than the government sector. NASA, being a government-funded organization, tends to do things in a very slow fashion anyway. The space shuttle is an example of engineering gone bad in a lot of ways. Its design was driven by politics in some cases, not by good engineering standards. Anyway, that's a different topic. So yeah, I think commercially we're going to see a lot of people going in orbit and such for that purpose. There's already private companies launching satellites and such rather than waiting for a government to do it. So I think that's the future of it. Yes?
What's the latest answer to the problem of light traveled more than the number of thousand years that...
I'm smiling because this has come up in every talk so far.
Yeah.
While I'm still talking to everybody, if anybody's interested in the question of how can we see light from stars that are apparently long distances away if the universe is yet young, there's a book on the back table that I'm about to describe to you. It's called Starlight and Time by Russell Humphreys. You only had two copies left last I saw. But if anybody's interested in this topic, then you can get a catalog and order it. I recommend it highly. It's the source of what I'm about to explain now. And do I want to do it here while everybody's here, or like privately?
Do it in 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay. Okay. Key concept is that Einstein predicted something which we have confirmed by experiment to be true, and that's that gravity affects time. The more gravity you are affected by, the slower time flows at your location, and it's not just that any particular physical thing slows down; everything slows down. Time itself is slower. In the U.S., our national standard for time is done by some atomic cesium clocks, which is the most accurate clock that anybody has, that's possible to have as far as we know, based on atomic processes. We have several of them in the country. There's one at sea level in Annapolis, Maryland, and one a mile or so above sea level in Boulder, Colorado. And the one in Colorado ticks, it doesn't really tick, but it ticks slightly faster than the one at sea level, even though they're identical clocks working on identical processes. Because time actually goes slightly more quickly the further out you get from the Earth's gravitational field. This is also an effect when designing the GPS satellites, by the way. GPS is already up there when I started working in space, but I saw all the design documents for them. And they had to compensate for this effect. Or they had to decide how to compensate for it, I should say. Anyway, point is, so if you're deeper in a gravitational field, time slows down for you. Okay, so that's a key concept. Now, Russell Humphreys, physicist, PhD, Bible-believing Christian, notices that the Bible says in something like 17 different places that God stretched out the heavens. He wonders, is that poetry, or is that a realistic description of something God did? If God stretched it all out physically, then that means it had to start off in a smaller volume. What would that look like? Well, if the entire mass of the universe was in a small enough space, you'd have a black hole. So where gravity is very intense, it starts doing weird things because all the matter is in a small volume. Now God stretches it out. When God stretches it out to a certain volume, the black hole effect shrinks down because it's not dense enough to all be a black hole now. Okay? The stuff on the outer rims of it is outside of the black hole effect zone. That's not the technical description, but simplifying. It is now out of the deep gravitational effect inside the black hole. Time starts flowing more quickly out here than in here. Okay? And in his model, the Earth is still in the middle. Stars and galaxies are being pulled out to here. Time is flowing more quickly for them. Earth in the middle, time is still going very slowly. As God continues to stretch, more material starts experiencing accelerated time, while in the Earth is still very slow. As God continues to stretch, eventually there comes a point where the universe is diffuse enough, it's spread out enough, that the black hole effect shrinks and disappears. There's no black hole anywhere. At that point, time flows the same across everywhere, which would be today. Today, our clocks are going the same as clocks out there. During this creation period, though, you could have 6 24-hour days going on according to Earth clocks, while clocks out in the farthest galaxy might register hundreds of millions of years, if not billions. So during that time, there would be time then for light to travel from out there to here, because more time is passing out here than in here. So the Bible is still true in that it says 6 24-hour days on Earth, because according to a clock on Earth, that's what it would measure. But a clock out here would measure something very different. It would measure a lot more time. And his model is consistent with the same evidence that's being used to promote the Big Bang. Starlight is stretched. Redshifted is the technical word. That could mean that the universe started like this and blew up in a big bang, or it could mean that God stretched the universe on purpose and the starlight was stretching along with it, which shifts the frequencies down into the red and decreases the energy and so on. And without boring anybody with geeky details, his model is consistent with what we see in the sky. In fact, he has an explanation for something that's going on with one of our spacecraft, the Pioneer spacecraft, which is leaving the solar system, and the Big Bangers do not. But if anybody wants details, you can come talk to me. I don't want to bore everybody. But anyway, that model comes out of the book, which is on the table back there. If you're interested in this topic, it's where I got the explanation from. I mean, he admitted the whole thing. Much better explanation of it than I can do. So I recommend it to you highly.
Good, great one for you. Think of the Big Bang Theory. You just went over what you've heard about. And I compare it to like an explosion in a metal scrapyard. And you have this big boom effect, and all these metal threads are flying out there. And it assembles into a Jumbo 747, all at once in the right spot, and everything else, and it becomes a jet that can fly. I mean, that's sort of my rational mind that helped this Big Bang and all the planets form. Well, if that's the case, then how would the evolutions explain the life sort of Earth from a primordial soup and bacteria and algae form the complex formation of animals and human beings? You know, like all these little systems that go in our body and how they function. You know, the explosions to create something that we see today. How do they explain that?
Well, I mean, I was sort of making fun of that idea by saying hydrogen turns into people. You know, obviously, we are at orders of magnitude of complexity above gases involved in an explosion. So I would say they don't have an explanation. I've seen people try to avoid the question by saying that evolutionary theory only applies to life, and so therefore the question of how life started is outside of evolution. Of course, in order to believe in the rest of it, you have to explain where life came from, and they would, well, whatever. This is a biology question which I'm not qualified to answer. But yeah, I agree with you that it's a huge problem, and all their explanations that I've seen have just been a bunch of hand-waving. Well, you know, we know what happens on Earth. So, George has some books on that specifically, right? We'll get into that aspect of it more. Yeah, so.
Thank you very much for coming. Be sure and take advantage of the refreshments and